if they had a temple, they would. And there are some signs that they are at least preparing that someday they might. Now, I've got the wrong glasses here, so that means anytime I read, I've got to lean over to read. I've got the right glasses. They're in a card that you can see if you look right up there someplace. Now, I need to know what you have in your books and whether it matches up with mine. I'm looking at Lesson 2, History. Do you have a page that says Lesson 2, History? Is there a first of those pages? Okay. My second page has Lesson 2, History in much smaller print, and page 2 way up in the upper right-hand corner. That may be the back of your page. Okay. Now, following that, I have some tables. I've got three more pages. How many pages do you have more? You've got one that says Kings of Israel, is that right? And you got another one that says Kings of Judah and Kings of Israel in four columns total. And then I've got a page that looks kind of like this. And that's it. When I go past that, I go to Lesson 3. Is that right? All right. Lesson 4. Well, that's interesting. We'll have to see what happens next week with Lesson 4. There were no books left over last week.
They didn't have any this time. They asked, and I said, we'll improvise.
All right. Now, somewhere there's a Lesson 3, because tonight is Lesson 2. But we'll worry about that when we get there. Okay? Now, the first thing I want to do is I want to orient you to the books that are in this part. Anytime anybody asks you how many books are there of this kind in the Old Testament, what are the two answers you have to choose from?
Five
and 12. What is the occasional answer that you give that isn't 5 and isn't 12?
17,
which is 5 plus 12. Somebody asks you about the prophets, it's 5 major prophets, 12 minor prophets, 17 total, right? Everybody okay? So, the law last week was 5 pages. It was 5 pages, 5 books. 5 pages, 5 books. This week is history. That's how many books?
12.
12. Very good. I do not know why it came out that way, but it came out that way. Now, the first two are Joshua and Judges. They both start with J. Joshua is named for Joshua. Joshua was the leader that Moses trained up, and he took over from Moses when Moses was gone. Something real interesting here I'm going to come back and pick up on, but we'll leave that for another moment. And I'm hoping my eyes will let me find them all. The book of Judges is named for a group of characters whose collective title was Judge. That probably isn't quite the right title, but it's as good as we've got. They were sort of like a combination of religious leader, high sheriff, military general, social worker, and sort of every other kind of thing you can have to provide the people with leadership. And almost always they would be people chosen by God for that special service in some way or another. The third of the books is Ruth. That's a very small book that has a very interesting place in the Bible record. And then what follows that are sets of books that are or ought to be called 1 and 2 books. There's 1st and 2nd Kings. But that follows 1st and 2nd Samuel. I think 1st and 2nd Samuel is first, and then 1st and 2nd Kings, and then 1st and 2nd Chronicles, and then 1st and 2nd Ezra, except they don't name it that way. They name it Ezra and Nehemiah, but it's really 1st and 2nd Ezra is a sort of a way to think of those. And the reason I'm asking you to think about them that way is that that joins together some information. If you're thinking about Samuel, there's 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, but that's a collection, 1 and 2 Kings. It's possible that those are divided out because of what fits in a standard scroll. You get a scroll this big, then it takes 2 scrolls to put those particular things in place. Okay? But think of Ezra and Nehemiah as a block. Think of 1 and 2 Chronicles as a block, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Samuel. So far, okay? Now, I think that's all the books I need to tell you about, so I'm going to go back now and make sure you know one more thing. The books of history run Joshua, Judges, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, Ezra, Nehemiah. First and Second Chronicles is a second version of what's contained between First Samuel and Second Kings. So you can take First and Second Chronicles and lay them down on top of the four books, First and Second Samuel, First and Second Kings, and there's a lot of overlap points. In the Gospels, the Gospel of Matthew tells you the story of Jesus. The Gospel of Mark tells you the story of Jesus. And if you lay those two books down on top of them, there's a lot of things in common. Okay? Sometimes almost the same words would appear. That's what happens between Chronicles and not 1st and 2nd Kings, but 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. So it's sort of like a two-volume version and a four-volume version. It's not real clear. Commentators discuss their theories of how it came to be that we have this, but it does look like there were probably two sets of history bookkeepers, and both of those were kept in. Sometimes you'll see some things in Chronicles that you don't see in Samuel and Kings. Sometimes you'll see some things in Samuel and Kings that you don't see in Chronicles. And sometimes you'll see things in both places. So far, okay? Now, the big story here in the history, because the truth is, you could talk about some of the things that were back in the law as history. The people of Israel came from Abraham's family to Isaac, to Jacob, whose name became Israel, and then to his 12 sons, and there was the group of people. One of their children was sold off by some of the other kids into slavery in Egypt and rose to power in Egypt and managed to have the family survive during the famine. All that is part of the historical record, but because it's not in the books we call history, we call it part of the law. So far, okay? So, all of that gives us a background for what happens. They come out of the promised land. They're ready to come out of Egypt. They wander in the wilderness. They're ready to go into the promised land, and that's the end of the books of the law. Joshua begins as the people are getting ready to go into the promised land. Truth is, this is the second time they're getting ready to go into the promised land. 2 years out of Egypt, Moses was ready to take them in. Two spies said we can do it. 10 spies said we can't. Majority rules apparently in those days, and the people decided to listen to the 10, not the 2, so they lost their chance to go into the promised land. 40 years of wandering in the wilderness so that those people who said we can't do it would die off, and their children that they said would be slaves or worse if they tried to go in would be the ones to do that. But the two spies were the ones who led it. Joshua was one of the two spies. Caleb was the other. So the book of Joshua talks about Joshua taking over the mantle of leadership. Okay? So they come into the promised land and they've got battles to fight. Parts of this are a little hard for a modern mind to wrap your head around, because there's a group of people being pushed out or killed off in order to make room for them. I don't know that I can give you an explanation for why that works that way. But I can tell you this. Somebody very wise one time said, you always have to read the Bible on at least two levels. You read the Bible on the level of what happened and where it happened and what the people at the time thought about it. And then you have to ask yourself, what's the lesson God teaches through that? And I'll give you this one for free. This fella says, if you really want to do this thing right, you take a look at the story of the children of Israel coming into the promised land and displacing the people in front of them. And you think about what happens in a human heart when God's Spirit tries to come into the human heart and tries to take care of the evil that's already there. It's got to push it out. It's got to make room. And any that doesn't get pushed out is going to sit there and cause problems for the rest of your life. I don't know if that helps me account for all that I read, but it certainly does put another twist or another spread on things. You leave sin in your life unaddressed, you're going to have problems later on. And if that allegory, if that picture of an allegory is right, maybe that's part of the message God is trying to send you. But here's what I want you to take a look at. I want you to go all the way back to the end of Genesis. And I want you to read the last verse of Genesis. There's some things in the Bible that I find challenging. There's some things in the Bible I find instructive. And there's some things in the Bible I find interesting. And this is one of those. What's the last verse
in Genesis? What does it talk about? Joseph died, and he was buried in Egypt. He was embalmed and laid in a coffin. They said he was buried in the manner of the Egyptians, which the Israelites would not have done. Okay? Now, where are we in the story? Joseph has brought his family in. Joseph has brought his family in. He's got food stored up for them and for all the Egyptians. And he's become one of the most powerful people around. His actions have saved the country of Egypt and have given it prominence, because all the grain that he stored up is enough to sell to the neighboring countries. But in the process of selling it, he takes over all the wealth of those countries. They have all had to essentially give away everything they have just to stay alive for those 7 years. Joseph has made Egypt the preeminent power in that part of the world, all under God's leadership. And I want you to look in my Bible. It's across the page, is the first chapter of Exodus. And I only have to go to the 8th verse. What does it say in the 8th verse? Chapter 1 of Exodus. The 8th verse. There arose, mine says, came to power in Egypt a new king who had never heard of Joseph. King James said, a person who knew not Joseph. Now, what happens if you don't know who Joseph was and all he had done for your country, and you're a new king in Egypt? You don't care about Joseph's family. You don't care about their people. And that's when they went into slavery. They got all these people. They're so numerous. If we're not careful, they'll take over the whole country. We'll just put them in slavery. Okay? So, Joshua comes along. And the book of Joshua tells the story of them coming into the promised land. It's real interesting how many of the things that happened to Moses and the people he led happen again to Joshua and the people he led. Everybody knows, probably because people of a certain age have seen the Cecil B. DeMille Ten Commandments movie, that there's this moment where the Red Sea was parted and Moses led the people through, right? There's a point like that in Joshua. There's a point where they come to a river, I think it's the Jordan River, and they cross on dry land because the river parts out for that. A lot of the power that Moses was able to display in the things that he led the people to do, Joshua was able to do that. And they came in and took over the things they needed to take over in the promised land. And the book of Joshua comes to a close. Okay? Take a look, not the last verse, but I think it's 5 or 6 verses from the end of the book of Joshua. Take a look at verse 29. This is Joshua 24, the last chapter of Joshua.
Okay, hold on a second. Yeah, not that far, right? What happens?
Joshua dies. Everybody okay? 5 verses later, the book of Joshua is over. Book of Judges. The book of Judges talks about what happens to people once they have settled in the land. The battles are over, they think. They're settled in the land. And something happens. Doesn't happen quite as quick as what I just showed you, but it happens pretty soon. Take a look at chapter 2. Verse 6. Chapter 2, verse 6 pretty much quotes, or at least paraphrases, what you just read back at the end of Joshua. Judges chapter 2, verse 6. Joshua, having dismissed the people, the Israelites then went away, each one to his own heritage, to occupy the country. The people served the Lord, what does it say? Throughout the lifetime of Joshua and throughout the lifetime of those elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the great deeds which the Lord had done for the sake of Israel. Now, verse 8 more or less repeats the verse you read. Joshua died. He was 110 years old when he died and was buried at a certain place. Verse 10. And when that whole generation had been gathered to its ancestors, another generation followed it. And what does it say about that generation? They didn't know the Lord, and they didn't know the deeds he had done for the sake of Israel. Now, folks, what happens when you forget what the Lord's done for you? What happens when you forget where you've come from, when you forget the good things God's done. Chances are everything's going to fall apart. The book of Joshua is the saddest book in the Bible, I think, because it shows a cycle that doesn't end through that whole book. The people forget who the Lord is, forget what He's done for them, and they start to do all kinds of things. Most of those things they're doing with people that were left in the land and weren't pushed out. That's that tension I told you about when you read this book. They start worshiping the idols that the people had before they got there. They start doing all these things, forget the Lord. And all kinds of terrible things come, including invading armies, famine, all kinds of stuff. What happens when you start to starve? What happens when an attacking army comes in? And you've been a follower of the Lord. You know something about that, but you've forgotten. Well, you cry out to God and you say, God, deliver me. And God raises up a leader, hero, judge. And that judge brings the people back to the Lord. And for one generation, maybe two, everybody's in right relationship with the Lord and everything's okay. Two generations goes by, maybe three, everybody forgets, right back out, and that cycle just goes and goes and goes and goes and goes and goes all the way through the book. It never stops.
Let me show you how this works. I'm just going to read the next few verses. I'm going to start at verse 11. It doesn't show all the pieces that you see every time, but it shows most of them. The Israelites then did what is evil in the Lord's eyes and served the Baals. That meant they were worshiping false idols. They deserted the Lord, the God of their ancestors, the God who had brought them out of Egypt, and they followed other gods, gods from these surrounding peoples. They bowed down to those. They provoked the Lord. They deserted the Lord to serve Baal and Astarte. Astarte was a fertility god. You worship the fertility god by having sex in the temple of that god. If you're female, there's males to service you. If you're male, there's females to service you. Temple prostitution, male and female. Baal worship was sometimes worse because that involved sometimes child sacrifice, although I think that's more associated with somebody with an idol named Moloch. The Lord's anger grew hot against Israel. He handed them over to pillagers who plundered them. He delivered them to their enemies surrounding them, and they were no longer able to resist their enemies. Whenever they mounted an expedition, the Lord's hand was there to foil them, as the Lord had told them, as the Lord had sworn to them. That's the book of Deuteronomy. I set before you blessings and curses. You've got to choose whether you're going to follow the Lord, and blessings will come, or whether you're going to reject Him, and destruction is going to come, and curses are going to come. You choose. As the Lord had sworn to them, as the Lord had told them. So they were in dire distress. What's missing here, but is present in most of the cycles, is this is the point at which the people cry out to God and say, God, we can't do this. We need your help. And so back to verse 16. The Lord then appointed them judges who rescued them from the hand of their plunderers. But even to their judges, they sometimes refused to listen, prostituting themselves to other gods, bowing down before these. Verse 18, when the Lord appointed judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and rescued them from the hands of their enemies as long as that judge lived. Verse 19, but once the judge was dead, they relapsed into even worse corruption than their ancestors, followed other gods and served them. And the cycle starts again. Cycle after cycle after cycle.
Almost anywhere you go in Judges, you'll find that. So, what are the low points in Judges? It's when the people are at their worst, paying no attention to the Lord, worshiping false idols, paying no attention to Him. And horrible things happen. They cry out for help and the Lord raises a leader. What's the high point? What are the high points in Judges? The things the leaders are able to do temporarily for short periods of time. So people like Gideon, if you've ever heard of Gideon, Gideon comes out of this chapter. He's one of the leaders. Every once in a while, there's a woman who comes up as a leader. Every once in a while, there's a woman. There's a woman by the name of Deborah who emerges as a leader. And she says at one point, you know, it's not really right for a woman to lead you. And they said, you're the only one we got. And off they go. So the high points of this book are when the leaders are raised up by God. And sometimes people will follow them, maybe for that generation, maybe for one or two, and then right back. We've lost sight of that treadmill as a people. We've lost sight of that. God says it's going to be there. I will tell you this much. Remember how I started talking last time about some things out of Hebrews? Did you pick up that Hebrews is a favorite book of mine? Did you pick that up? There's a place over there where they start talking about the heroes of the Bible. It's called the faith chapter in Hebrews. Smack in the middle of that is a Gentile, not an Israelite, a Gentile prostitute. Her name's Rahab. She shows up in this book. Or in the book before, I forget which, I think she was in Joshua. So this unlikely people come along. Samson shows up in here. Samson's probably the worst judge they ever got. But you learn some lessons from him. You can be as strong as a bull, but if you don't pay attention to what the Lord's trying to lead you to do, eventually your strength isn't going to be able to keep you going. Hard stories in here. I've got a little set of words written down on this page. I hope it's okay with you that I don't just read you this stuff. I think that'd be boring as could be, but I will read you this. The key to the book is the tragedy of this cycle. In Deuteronomy, there's a place in 12:8 where you see God says you must not do these things. Judges 17:6, 21:25, and so forth. That's what they did, and the chickens came home to roost, as you said. Okay, let's go briefly to the book of Ruth, because that's a transition into the books of the first and the second that sort of finish all this out. Okay, in the book of Ruth, we're introduced to a character, Ruth. But before them, we're introduced to Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, and Naomi's family. There's a famine. That happened every once in a while. If you remember, God would send in invading armies. God would send famine. God would send all kinds of things, right? So there was a famine. There wasn't enough food. And there's a man and his wife. His wife was Naomi. Two sons. Didn't have enough to eat, so they got up and left and went to a foreign country. The country they went to was Moab. While they were there, the two boys married Moabite women. I'm quoting now from one of the translations. And Ruth was one of these people. The husband died. The first son died. The second son died. What you got now? You got three widows and a family at a time when it's hard for one widow to live. And Naomi says to her daughters-in-law, I'm going to go back home. If I'm going to die, I'm going to at least die at home. You all aren't from there. You don't know the people. You don't know the customs. So you just stay here. Find yourself some husbands here in Moab. One of the daughters-in-law turned back. No shame in that. And Ruth said something that ends up quoted in so many wedding ceremonies, it's not funny. How does King James put it? Because some of you know this because you've been to a few weddings. Entreat me not to leave you. Where you are, there I will be. Your family will be my family. Beautiful, beautiful words, right? That was Ruth, a daughter-in-law, talking to her mother-in-law. So they come back home. They come back home. And they're starving. There's no Social Security. They don't have any money. They spend everything they've got. And Naomi says to Ruth, look, there's a law here. This law is still in effect from Moses. And that is, when you reap the crops in a field, when you take the crops out of a field, you can't take everything. You get one pass if you're a farmer, and that's it. You can't go back and pick up stuff that fell off the truck or fell off the wagon or that fell out of people's hands. If it falls out of your hands, it stays there. And the poor people can come into the field, and they can pick up the little bit that was left by the harvesters. What's that process called? Some of you know this word. Gleaning. And so she sent Ruth to glean the field. And she came home one night, and she had a few gifts from the farmer. Now, gifts from a farmer could mean all kinds of things to a widow who was poor. They could be a sign that she was being taken advantage of. And Naomi says to her, what farmer gave you this? And Ruth tells her. And she says, oh, my child,
you've got the one good farmer I know about. He's kin to us. In fact, he's one of the ones who has the right of redemption over us. Now, if you don't know what the right of redemption is, you get lost in the middle of this story. The right of redemption is actually referred to in one of the stranger things that Jesus ever talked about. Somebody who didn't believe in the resurrection said, well, what's going to happen on resurrection day if you got a woman who marries somebody and he dies and she marries his brother and he dies and she marries another brother and she ends up marrying seven brothers in the world and they all die and then she dies, she goes to heaven. Whose husband is? Which one's going to be her husband? Now, Jesus got an interesting answer, and I'll send you to the Gospels to find out what his answer is. But here's the point. If you're a male, and you have a brother who dies, but his wife is still alive, and your brother does not have children, then one of the expectations is that you will take that woman to be your wife. They did practice multiple marriages in those days. You will take that brother's wife, one just long enough to produce an heir for your brother. That's not your heir. It'll be your brother's heir, so the things your brother has will have it. It has to be that blood kin, right? So she says, this is one of the people in the family who has the right of redemption over us. That comes a little bit later in the story. This fella, you all remember his name? A few of you might know it. His name was Boaz. Okay. There's, I think, a Goodwill store here in town. It's got the name Ruth and Boaz, right? And the idea is that idea of gleaning. You got some stuff left over that poor people might be able to make some use out of. And so there's people who work there that's their living, just trying to take those things and make them useful, and then they sell them. And that puts a little bit of money on the table for folks who might not have a nice name for that place. Boaz starts to realize Ruth's a pretty nice person, nicer than anybody he knows. He's not married yet. And he starts to realize, this is a kin person, and he can do God's will if he takes care of her, takes her to be his wife. I think at the time he didn't have a wife, but that wasn't necessarily part of the story. But it turns out there's one guy ahead of him. So he goes and seeks this guy out, has this conversation with him. He says, have you seen Ruth, this Moabite woman who's come in? You realize you've got the right of redemption over her ahead of me? The guy says, yeah, I know that. And so he starts talking to her, and what happens is he starts to realize if he enters with that marriage, there's all kinds of economic issues. I don't understand them all either, but I'm told by the commentators. There's all kinds of things that happen that start to complicate his life. And he finally says, you know, I'm not sure I want to do that anyway. And Boaz makes him relinquish his claim, and Moaz marries her. That's just a little love story set in the middle of the Bible. Only thing is, it turns out her grandson is David. Or her great-grandson, I think it's her grandson, it's David, who becomes the greatest king that Israel ever had. And whose descendant many times further down is Jesus Christ. And the Bible says of David, God said, I'm going to raise up somebody in David's line who will be king forever. So here's this foreign woman, second one I've mentioned tonight, Rahab a little bit earlier, Ruth now. Comes into the Bible story, and the history books tell you about this. Neat story.
Yeah.
That's a word that's used, and it. The best thing I can tell you is if you listen to people preach on these subjects, or if you listen to Sunday school lessons on these subjects, the thing that they will most show is that in order to have the right of redemption, you must be kin. And so Boaz is termed a kinsman redeemer. Kinsman redeemer. And the references in the New Testament to talk about Christ as our brother, who is our redeemer, they see parallels. It's not perfect parallels by any means, but they see parallels to them. And it is redemption in the sense of these are people whose existence is on the edge of starvation. But a kinsman redeemer can bring them out of that. So the term is properly used, although awkwardly used, I think.
Now, if you go back to the end of Judges,
you see that that story was running, that cycle and that cycle and that cycle. And there's a sentence that shows up, I don't know, half a dozen times, 10 times, I don't know how many times it shows up. But it also shows up as the last phrase, the last sentence in the book of Judges. Can you find the last sentence in the book of Judges? I think it will be probably the last verse. Yeah, but read the whole verse. In those days, there was no king in Israel, comma. Everybody does whatever he sees fit. You go back to the book of Deuteronomy, and it's hard to count how many times God says, when you're settled in the land, I don't want you just to do whatever you see is fit. I want you to follow me as king. And so the story of 1 Samuel is the transition into earthly kings, human kings. The book of 1 Samuel opens with the birth of a baby.
One of these days I'm going to work on a series of lessons on the births of babies that figure prominently in the Bible record. You go into the New Testament, you may not remember this, you may not know this yet, but you've heard of John the Baptist, most of you, you've certainly heard of Jesus. They're cousins. Okay. John the Baptist was born to a woman named Elizabeth, who was Mary, Jesus' mother's cousin. But Elizabeth had been childless all her life. And she had prayed and prayed and prayed for a son, and John the Baptist was an answer to prayer. You go back into the Old Testament and the New Testament, numerous times there's a baby that's born to a woman who was childless. Abraham himself started the whole thing off. Right? He had to wait and wait and wait until he was almost 100 before Isaac was born.
Okay? So, that kind of thing happens all the time. Well, in this particular case, there was a woman. It tells you where she was from. The very first verse of first verses of 1 Samuel identifies for you the husband and the wives. If you look at verse 2, the man had two wives. One was called Hannah, and one was called Peninnah. And it says, Peninnah had children. But what about Hannah? None. Year after year, she prayed for children, she prayed for children. And finally, she prayed, and she said, if you'll give me a child, I'll give him back to you to serve you all his life in the temple. That's what she said to God. She had a baby. She kept him until he was about 2, I think, maybe 3. Took him back to the temple and left him at the temple for the rest of his life. Said every year she'd go up and give him a change of clothes, give him new clothes once a year on a trip to the temple. That child was Samuel, the one for whom this is named. And Samuel was the last of the judges and the first of the prophets. Because in these books of history, all the prophets are laying across here too. The prophets are not way over there in the books of history, way over here. The prophets are functioning all the way through here. And every once in a while they show up in the record. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But the prophets are functioning across this time. Okay? So Samuel was the first of the prophets and the last of the judges. But he starts out in the Bible record just a little kid.
He was working in the temple. The priest who was in charge of the temple was a man named Eli. And Eli was good, but he couldn't control his kids. He's got two sons. The two sons are taking over from him as priests, and they are not good. They're taking bribes because priests have judicial duties as well. They don't respect the sacrifices that were made. And eventually, on a single day, both of those die. And so does Eli. And somewhere in there, Samuel takes over as the spiritual leader, God's person on the ground. The anguish that comes into Samuel's life comes in around the question of leadership, because when Samuel gets old, his own children start to take over from him, and they're bad too. And the people say to Samuel, we don't want your sons to be leading us. We want a king. Okay? That's the way they say it that breaks your heart. So let me see if I can find them. Yep, here it is. First Samuel chapter 8. First Samuel chapter 8. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges of Israel. His eldest son was called Joel, and his second one Abijah. They were judges at Beersheba. His sons did not follow his example, but seduced by the love of money, took bribes, and gave biased verdicts. And the elders of Israel all assembled, went back to Samuel at Ramah, and said, "Look, you're old, your sons are not following your example, so give us a king to judge us like the other nations." And here's the things I want you to see in this. Here are the things I want you to see in this. First of all, these are books of history, right? The historian, the person who under God's inspiration wrote this down, has given you a judgment on people. He has given you, or they have given you, a historical evaluation of the person. What does he say about Saul's sons, Samuel's sons, in verse 3? They did not follow Samuel's example. That is a judgment of history. And throughout these books of history, throughout 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and throughout 1 and 2 Chronicles, which covers the same territory, every time there's a prominent leader, almost every time, the historian or the historians are going to give you God's judgment of that person. All right? But I want to focus on the second thing. The second thing is the people said, "Give us a king to judge us like the other nations." Go to verse 19. Now, in between is the most fascinating thing. Samuel tells them, if you get a king, you're not going to like it. They're going to tax all your money. They're going to take your children into their harems. They're going to take your sons and make soldiers out of them. They're going to take your crops. They're going to take your houses. It's going to be awful. You don't want to do that. Verse 19. But the people, however, refused to listen to Samuel and said, "No, we are determined to have a king." Now, here's the words I want you to hear. "So that we can be just like the other nations." Back in the first five books of the Bible, there's this wonderful moment where God says, "I have chosen you of all the nations on earth to be my special people. I will be your king, you will be my people, and you won't be like any other nation on earth." And what did the people just say? Did you hear it? "We want to have a king. We don't want you leading us. We want to have a king so we can be just like all the other people." And that broke Samuel's heart. I got to tell you, there's another time in Scripture where something almost just like that happens, except it is thousands of times worse. It is thousands of times worse. And I want to take you there while you're at this spot. Part of my job is to show you this is not a little bit here and a little bit here and a little bit here. This is a connected body of inspiration, insight, words from our Lord. And I want to help you see the connections. So where I'd like you to go, I think, is the book of John. I forgot to look this up, but I think we're okay. Yep. John chapter 19. John chapter 19. It certainly would be appropriate for this, but I doubt seriously this was the first time it became appropriate. And I doubt you think that either. Okay? First, you got John 19, right?
Yep.
I'm going to start reading at verse 12, and I didn't tell you where it was, so you'd have to start right where I am and not get too far ahead. From that moment, Pilate was anxious to set him free. Set who free? This is Jesus, and we're just about to have him condemned to death. But the Jews shouted, "If you set him free, you're no friend of Caesar's. Anyone who makes himself king is defying Caesar." Hearing those words, Pilate had Jesus brought out and seated him on the chair of judgment. That's the place the leader sat. At a place called the pavement, in Hebrew called Gabbatha. It was the day of preparation, about the sixth hour. "Here is your king," Pilate said to the Jews. But they shouted, "Away with him, away with him, crucify him." Pilate said, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the chief priests answered, "What? We have no king save Caesar." Then Pilate handed him over to be crucified. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 19. Oh no, we're determined to have a king so we can be just like every other nation. God didn't call you to be just like every other nation. God called you to be special. God called you to be set apart. That's what holy means, set apart for service. Verse 22, still in 1 Samuel 8. I know you probably lost that while we got over to John. Part of the practice is to go back and forth, see if you can do it. The Lord then said to Samuel, "Do as they ask and give them a king." Now, I can't take all day telling you about Saul, but the first king they picked looked like a king. He was taller than anybody, handsomer than anybody, stronger than anybody, and when they went to look for him to make him king, he was hiding in the baggage because he didn't want to have anything to do with it. And there's a point where Samuel says to him, "As small as you are in your own eyes, God would have given you the kingdom if you just obeyed." Samuel's got a problem. And it's not an ego problem. It's the opposite. He's got an inferiority complex, and it just overwhelms. Looks like a king, but doesn't work. So partway through Saul's reign, God says to Samuel, "You know, he looks like a king. People are happy with him looking like a king, but I'm not. I want you to go appoint me another king." And he goes over to Ruth's grandson, Jesse, because that's where God told him to go. And God says, "I want you to anoint one of Jesse's sons, one of Ruth's great-grandsons, I think. And I want you to find him and anoint him as king." And Samuel comes, and all he says to Jesse is, "I'm coming for dinner." And Jesse gets scared as the dickens. If George Bush called you tomorrow and said, "I'm coming to dinner," what would you think? If Tim Kaine called and said, "Ann, can you have supper ready for me? I'm going to eat it." What are you going to do when the governor comes, when the president comes, right? Well, here comes Samuel. It's the same kind of thing. All he said is, "I'm coming for supper." And they're all shaking like crazy. And as he's sitting there for supper, the eldest son comes walking up, and he says, "Lord, you did great. This is a good one." And God says in his ear, "That ain't the one." Now, I've learned God doesn't talk in language like that, and I probably shouldn't either. That's not the one. And so the second one comes, and you hear Samuel saying words to the effect of, "Well, okay, that's not quite as good as the first one, but that's not bad." God says, "Not him either." In fact, he goes through all of Jesse's sons who are there, and not a one of them is the one. And he says to Jesse, "Don't you have another son?" And you hear Jesse say, and if you read at this point and understand what's been said before, you realize Jesse's almost certainly saying this, "Well, there's one more, but he's just out taking care of the sheep." As if to say, how could you possibly be interested in that? And that one is David. It's the greatest king they ever had. Solomon may have been richer. Solomon may have had more smarts. But David was the better king. And David says to Samuel in his ear, "That's the one, because he's got a heart like mine. This is a man after my own heart." What a judgment from the Lord. Now let's just get this straight. This is a book of history, right? By the time David's life is over, he's a murderer. He's an adulterer. And he's got blood on his hands like nothing. But God still said, "This is a man after my own heart." Why would God say that? You have to look. But every once in a while you find something and you realize, wait a minute, David isn't behaving like anybody else would behave. David isn't behaving like anybody else. And that's the clue. David every once in a while behaves in a way that nobody would behave. Maybe you're getting a glimpse of God's heart. Or maybe you're getting a glimpse of radical obedience to God.
Remember the adultery I told you about? Bathsheba, if you've heard that word. Bathsheba's got a husband. Husband's name is Uriah, and the Bible tells us he was a Hittite. But you know what else the Bible tells us? David had a choice bodyguard of his most powerful soldiers, and Uriah was one of the 30. The elite guard who would have given their lives for David. That was Bathsheba's husband, was one of those. And he arranged things so that Uriah would be put in the front of a battle, and the generals in charge of the battle would withdraw the troops in a way that Uriah wouldn't realize it would happen, and Uriah would be dead, and David could have Bathsheba. And it happened. And they had a baby, David and Bathsheba. And the baby turned sick and was about to die. And David was distraught. He wouldn't wash, he wouldn't eat. All he would do is weep and cry in prayer to the Lord. And his servant said, he's going to die of this if we're not careful. And the baby dies. And the servants say, we can't tell him. Because if he hears this, it'll kill him. And finally, one of them gets enough courage to go and tell him. And David gets up, and he washes his face, and he has a meal, and he walks away. And the servants say, why are you acting this way? And he said, until he died, God might have relented. But God has now spoken. And I have to accept what God did. Later in his life, David had all kinds of turmoil in his family. The worst of them was another son who wanted to be king. He decided David had gotten old enough. David needed to be set aside and somebody else become king. And he thought, I'm the one for the job. Name was Absalom. Beautiful, beautiful Absalom. Long, long blonde hair, they say, of the body. So Absalom mounted a coup. He arranged soldiers, he arranged military power, he arranged political power, he overthrew his father and was ready to kill his father hadn't been able to escape with a few hand-picked soldiers to guard him as a rear guard as they left. And he hunted David and tried to kill him. And the day finally came that Absalom died. And they brought word to David, Absalom's dead. What would any right-thinking person say? Help me here. Hallelujah. Good riddance. Hallelujah. David wept like he had never wept in his life. Listen to his words. Oh, Absalom. Oh, Absalom, my son Absalom, would God I had died for you. Do you hear it? David saw something of God's heart that he could say, I wish I had been able to die for a rebellious child. Because that's what God did, was to die in Jesus for his rebellious child. His rebellious child, me. His rebellious child, you. So if anybody invites you to read something about David, jump at the chance. Jump at the chance. Now, it's time for us to take a moment away from these two pages. I want to take you over here to this thing for a second, right? Now, I want to first of all take you to the funny looking page like this. David was king. His son Solomon was king, the richest and supposedly smartest king there ever was. And after Solomon, Solomon's son became king, and Solomon's son listened to the wrong people. He listened to the wrong advice. He didn't seek the Lord's advice. He sought the advice of his friends, and the kingdom ended up splitting into two parts. And what this page does is to show you those two parts. These are terms you need to know. On the left side it says Judah at the top. On the right side it says Israel. Well, the whole country was Israel. But when that nation divided, then the northern part of the nation retained the name Israel. And the southern part took on the name Judah. By the time Jesus came, the region around Jerusalem was known as the region of Judah. Because that was generally the area of the southern kingdom. The northern kingdom was known as Israel, but it was also known for its capital city, because the northern kingdom didn't have Jerusalem. They had to set up a rival worship center. They call that place Samaria. So the northern kingdom was also sometimes called Samaria for that city that they built as their capital. And the people who lived there might be referred to as Samaritans. The northern kingdom was destroyed by Assyria and taken into captivity. And the Assyrians came and besieged Jerusalem, and the siege was broken in a way that you have to have a little faith to believe it. 186,000 soldiers died in one night. The Bible says an angel of the Lord came in, one angel of the Lord. 186,000 soldiers are dead the next morning. No army to fight. The southern kingdom is spared. Jesus said to some of his followers, I could call on 10 legions of angels. One angel, 186,000 soldiers dead. How much did 10 legions take? They can do the job. Northern kingdom, southern kingdom. In bold over here are the names of some prophets. And there's a timeline down through there. The timeline down there on the right side is the kings of Israel. The time down the line on the left side are the kings of Judah. Everybody okay? Now, set that aside for just a moment. There's a map in the middle, sort of generally shows places. I thought that might help you. And now take a look at the other two pages. I want you to, if you can, I don't know if you're able to do this, because I think they're front and back, so you have to sort of flip. I can look at them side by side, so I've got an advantage over you. Maybe if there's two of you there, one of you turn to one page, one turn to the other. Okay? Because here's what I want you to see. On the page that has text at the top and then the columns down here in the bottom, see that? I've got that same list. Here's the kings of Judah, here's the kings of Israel. And there's about the same number of kings, right? Except the kings of Judah all end in 732 B.C. and the kings of Israel, end in 732, and the kings of Judah keep going for almost another 150 years, 597 B.C. That's when the Babylonians take over the southern kingdom. So far, okay? Now, if you look at this page, you got the same thing. The left column and the third column simply reproduce this with a little bit more space. And what I've got on this page is some comments. And I want you to take a look towards the bottom on the side, the Israel side. Look at the last five kings and tell me who they were. Each one, except one, was the assassin of the king before. That's not a very stable government, folks. That's not a very stable government. Still okay? All right. Now, for a moment, just take a look at this page that has the text at the top and the words up front. Just take a look at that one page. Okay? And I want you to take a look. It's toward the bottom of the text. There's a place where the lines open up just a little bit. There's a little bit of space between the lines. You see that? And I want to read in there. Remember I told you about the historians making a judgment, giving you God's judgment on these kings, right? So every king, I think, has a judgment recording. What I've tried to do is summarize that for you. So here's the way it works. If you see a little D as a superscript next to the king's name, that means that the judgment of the history, God's judgment recorded by the historians, was that they were recorded as having displeased God in what they did. If you see a squiggle line, it means what? Some of what they did pleased God, and some of what they did didn't please God. If you see a capital P, what does that say? They pleased God. Now, I'd like you to look down the right-hand side and tell me how many do you see that pleased God. What's the best you got?
You got D+.
You got a D+. That's the best you got. You got two D+ right there over about 15 or 20 year period. You got two D+. That's the best you got on that side. Right? How about on the left side? How many do you see? Partly and fully. Answer is a few. Do you see a difference between the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom? Okay, so go back to the other sheet that has the map on it. How many prophets came to the northern kingdom in the time period that we're talking about? These are the big, bold words. Elijah, Obadiah, Elisha, Jonah, Hosea. Five. How many came to the southern kingdom?
Four.
And three of those came after the northern kingdom was gone. God sent prophets to the place that needed the prophets the most, and it didn't work. God did everything He could do on His part. And when it started looking really bad for the southern kingdom, the prophets started coming here, and that wasn't enough.
Is this interesting? You can do this. All you got to do is just go through, find one of these, just read along.
Every time there's a king, a new king, it'll tell you, he started his reign at such and such an age, he reigned this long, he became king when so-and-so was king, and he names the king of the other one. So, you know, each one sort of lines it up, and that's all I've done, is just sort of pick those up, plus picked a couple of commentators and picked up the timeline from there. Okay?
Now, I'd like for you to take a look, just a moment,
on the long sheet over on the side of Judah. You doing okay with me so far? And I want you to go down a little, well, go down to the first one that has a capital T. First one that has a capital T. Hezekiah. What does it say about him? He was the one who was king when Judah was spared from that invasion of Assyria. Assyria takes over the northern kingdom and almost takes the southern kingdom. Hezekiah was king when that happened. Hezekiah was king when that happened. So tell me about his son, the next king.
Worst king Judah ever had. How long was he king?
Now, you have to do a little oddball subtraction here, right? Manasseh became king in 687, and his son became king in 642. 45 years.
The worst king for the longest time, okay? Now, I want to take you to Josiah. And I want to take you to Josiah specifically so I can show you something. Remember I told you it got bad? Well, I want to try to help you see how bad it got. So I'd like you to take a look at chapter 22 of 2 Kings.
2 Kings, chapter 22.
Looks like there's a little bit. Oh, you're correct. You got from the first. The oldest one is the first king.
Second Kings. 22. You doing okay? Everybody okay?
Do not let yourself get upset because you're having trouble finding something. Look around for somebody to help you find it and just see it. You'll get better. I haven't started playing the guitar yet. When I start, I'm going to look worse than you. My son started to bug me because I said something at home about it this week. Okay?
Yes.
How old was Josiah when he became king?
8 years.
How old?
8 years.
What kind of a king can you be at the age of 8?
He was 8 years old when he became king.
He reigned for 31 years. His mother's name was Jedidiah. Some translations say Jedidah. Some others say. When I get to some of those names like that, let me give you a little clue. Pronounce them as if you know what you're doing and everybody will believe you do. Or find a way to skip over. His mother had a certain name and she was the daughter of somebody with another name. And then just move on, right? He did what the Lord regards as right and in every respect followed the example of his ancestor David, not deviating it from it to the right or to the left. That's a capital P, folks. That's the judgment of God. As recorded by the historians of God his father. Okay? Mm-hmm. In the 18th year of King Josiah, now, it's not clear to me whether he's 18 or whether he's been king 18 years. I think he's 18. I think he's been king 10 years. I think he's 18. Commentators kind of go back and forth on that, but I think that's what it was. Now, I'm just going to read this to you. If we run out of time, that's okay.
I'll tell you this much.
The northern kingdom ended in captivity to Assyria, and the northern kingdom lost much of their identity. The Samaritans in Jesus' day were half-breed, folks who had intermarried but were left from that people. The southern kingdom was taken over by the Babylonians, taken into exile, but some of them managed to maintain their identity and were able to come back. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah are in the post-exile period, and they're talking about resettling the land. And there's powerful things in there. If I have time, I'll do those. But I want you to see this one first.
In the 18th year of King Josiah, the king sent the secretary Shaphan, son of so-and-so, son of so-and-so, to the temple of the Lord. Go to Hilkiah, the high priest, tell him to melt down the silver contributed to the temple of the Lord and collected by the guardians of the threshold from the people. Hand it over to the masters of the works attached to the temple of the Lord for them to pay it over to the men working on the temple of the Lord to repair the damaged parts of the temple, to the carpenters, to the builders, to the masons, and for buying timber and dressed stones for the temple repairs. The latter were not required to render account of the money handed over to them because they were conscientious in their work. He had some real trustworthy people, and what's he doing? He said, we're going to repair the temple. What's the implication? The temple needed repairing, right?
King says to his secretary, that would be sort of like the Secretary of State or the Chief of Staff in the President's office. Okay, you go to the high priest, that's the person in charge of the temple, and you have them start, take the money we've been collecting, have them rebuild. Maybe that's what they've been doing for the first 10 years of his reign. He's turned 18. That's old enough to start to take over responsibility.
Verse 8, there's a little something missing in here, but I'll tell you what it is. They start the repairs and they find something. Verse 8. The high priest Hilkiah said to Shaphan the secretary, the news is now coming back up the chain. I have found the book of the law in the temple of the Lord. Pause for a minute. Where in the world should the book of the law be?
In the temple of the Lord. What's so remarkable about that?
Keep reading. Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, who read it. Shaphan went to the king, reporting furthermore to him as follows: your servants have melted down the temple, melted down the silver which was in the temple, and handed over to the masters of the works. Shaphan, the secretary, informed the king, the priest Hilkiah has given me a book.
Does your translation say it that way? Has given me a book. This isn't a book. This is the book.
He's given me a book. And Shaphan read it aloud in the king's presence. And on hearing the words of the book of the law, the king tore his clothes. What does that mean? Great grief. Disaster has fallen. Why? The king gave the following order to the priest, and he gives all kinds of other people he gives it to, including Shaphan. And Asaiah, the king's minister, go and consult the Lord on behalf of me and the people about the words of the book that has been discovered, for the Lord's furious wrath has been kindled against us because our ancestors disobeyed the word of the Lord by not doing what this book says they ought to have done. How bad did it get?
Manasseh has been king for 45 years, and there's been a whole line of kings before him that weren't a whole lot better. And they don't even know what the book of the law says, because they haven't seen it in their lifetime. And they suddenly find it and read it, and they say, oh my God, if we don't do what's in this book, disaster is coming, and we're not doing what's in this book.
Gets better. The priest Hilkiah and Ahikim and Achbor and Shaphan and Ahaziah all went together to the prophetess, catch that, to the prophetess Huldah, the wife of a certain one, etc., etc., the keeper of the wardrobe. She lived in Jerusalem in the new town, and they put the matter to her. Now catch this, folks.
Here's the high priest of God, and he's never seen the book of the law. Here's the king. He's never seen the book of the law. Here's every government minister. They've not seen the king of the law, the book of the law. And when they find it, realize what it says, realize what it is, who do they go to find out what to do? They go to a woman. You listen carefully when people say women can't lead.
you listen carefully when people say women can't be the spiritual leader. Thank God for this one, because she's the only one left that understands what this is. And they know enough to know that. Verse 19, in the middle of her comment, she says, yes, you're right. Horrible things are coming because you've ignored all this, but since your heart has been touched, and you've humbled yourself before the Lord on hearing what I've decreed in this place and the people who live in it, against this place and the people who live in it, how they will become an object of horror and cursing, and since you have torn your clothes and wept before me, I have heard. And so when I gather you to your ancestors, she's speaking to the king now, you will be gathered into your grave in peace. You will not live to see the great disaster which is coming. And they took that answer to the king. Verse 20, chapter 23, verses 1 through 3, the king goes in public and binds himself to what the book commands. And then he starts cleaning out the temple. This is what I want you to see. How bad was it? Verse 4, chapter 23. We're still in the same place. Verse 4, chapter 23. They're starting to clean out the temple. What do they clean out? The priest ordered Hilkiah, with the priest next in rank and the guardians of the threshold, to move all the cult objects which had been made for Baal, Asherah, and the whole array of heaven. They were worshiping false idols inside the temple. They were worshiping everything except God inside the temple. He burnt them outside Jerusalem in the fields of Kidron and had the ashes taken to Bethel. He exterminated the spurious priests whom the kings of Judah had appointed and who offered sacrifice on the high places in the towns of Judah and the neighborhood of Jerusalem, and also to those who offered sacrifice to Baal, to the sun, to the moon, to the stars, to the whole array of heaven. From the temple of the Lord, he took down the sacred pole outside Jerusalem to Kidron Valley, and in the Kidron Valley he burnt it. Verse 7, he pulled down the house of the sacred male temples, male prostitutes, which was in the temple of the Lord, and where the women were prostitutes for Asherah. They had male and female prostitutes functioning inside the temple. How bad was it, folks? Nobody much has read this. How bad can it get? It can get awful. But when it gets awful, disaster's around the corner. Verse 10, he rendered unsanctified Tophet, that's the name of one of the false idols, in the valley of Ben-Hinnom, so that no one could pass his son or daughter through the fire of sacrifice to Moloch. They were sacrificing children down in the valley, just down the hill from the temple, killing them in the name of false gods within sight of the temple. He destroyed the horses which the kings of Judah had dedicated to the sun at the entrance to the temple of the Lord. You can't even get into the temple without passing idol worship to the sun. He burned the solar chariot. He pulled down altars which the kings of Judah had built on the roof. There were false gods being worshipped on the roof of the temple. He pulled those down, threw their rubble into the Kidron Valley. Now you find out how bad it was and how early in the next verse. So let me just prepare you for this. Who was responsible for building the temple? Who did God use to build the temple? Solomon. Just in case you don't know. So here was Saul set aside for David. Here's David's son Solomon, the greatest and wisest king there was, right? Well, how did all this stuff get there? Verse 15. The king rendered unsanctified the high places facing Jerusalem to the south of the Mount of Olives, which Solomon, king of Israel, had built for Astarte, the city an abomination, for Chemosh, the Moabite abomination, and for Milcom, the Ammonite abomination. He also smashed the sacred pillars, cut down the sacred poles, and covered with human bones the places where they had stood. Who put all that stuff up? Solomon did. Why? Because Solomon had 3,000 foreign wives and he let every one of them worship in the temple. They built the temple, and within the lifetime of the kings who built it, the whole place was just a running sore. How bad did it get? It got bad, and it got bad quickly. And Joash cleaned it all up. And in verse 21 of chapter 3, for the first time in decades, they celebrated the Passover.
Verse 25 of chapter 23, no king before him had turned to the Lord as did Josiah. With all his heart, with all his soul, with all his strength, in perfect loyalty to the law of Moses, nor did any king like him arise again. How bad did it get? Pretty bad. Now, I'm running low on time to tell you any more stories. I got one good one out of Ezra and Nehemiah. We're just going to have to forego that. Someday get me in the corner, get me a cup of coffee, I'll try to share something with you. Have I gotten you hungry to read the history? Are you starting to realize there just might be something in here that's either interesting to read in the first place or maybe instructional? I'll try not to draw too many parallels between those days and our days. I'll leave those to you. I'll leave those to you.
Certainly seems parallel.
There are some. There are some. I thank you for your attention. I thank you for your presence. Is there a lesson three in your book?
No, not in mine.
Does anybody have a lesson three? I know you don't have a lesson three immediately following on lesson two. You have a lesson three anywhere. So you have one down. Yeah. Yeah, but you've got that red book that you got tonight, all right? Okay. Ralph, looks like we got a job, don't we? Okay. If anybody is really desperate to have this before next week, one of us will go with you to a copy machine. We'll burn up all the paper in it. Otherwise, we'll try to get you a copy next week. I will tell you, if you just read all the Psalms and all the Proverbs and all the Ecclesiastes and all the Song of Solomon and all Lamentations, you'll be okay.
Yeah.
Do that and you'll be okay for next week. Okay. Thank you for being here. Good night.
Thank you.